Facebook on Friday said it is ready to be a friend to the news industry. The world's leading social network unveiled a new feed for its mobile app called Facebook News. News solely from professional media outlets, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, and BuzzFeed.
Johnson & Johnson baby powder is being pulled from shelves by three major U.S. retailers. J&J had recalled some bottles over possible asbestos contamination last week. Now Walmart, CVS, and Rite Aid are removing all 22-ounce bottles of the product. Johnson & Johnson faces more than 15,000 lawsuits over its products.
What is believed to be the world's oldest natural pearl was unveiled in Abu Dhabi on Sunday. Dubbed the Abu Dhabi Pearl, it was discovered at a Neolithic site on the Marawa Island underneath layers which were carbon dated to 5,800 to 5,600 BC.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Monday. It's October the 28th, and it's 5:09 in the morning. Thank you for tuning in for another edition of The Opening Bell. We've got another business week and another business day getting underway here, and lots of intel to get through this morning. We'll hit some of the market numbers here momentarily, get to a couple of the top business stories as well on the program today. And we really think we put together a great broadcast for you today. Doug White is here, a philanthropy advisor, to talk to us a little bit about how giving, you don't want to give to charitable organizations that might be a scam or aren't what they say they are. Doug is the author of Wounded Charity, Lessons Learned from the Wounded Warrior Project Crisis, co-chair of Foolproof Foundation's Walter Cronkite Project Committee. Doug will be with us first up this morning as giving season gets underway. Some good tips for you about giving. A little bit later in the program, another disappointment, it appears, from Foxconn up in Wisconsin. And D.L. Busk will be here to help us sort through it. A contributor at the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Chief Executive Magazine. It appears that perhaps Foxconn isn't living up to its deal with Wisconsin still. That'll be at about 5:38 this morning. But first, let's begin on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk with futures pointing toward opening gains on Wall Street a little bit later this morning. Dow, NASDAQ, and S&P futures are all up about 0.25% this morning. In Europe, markets are generally mixed. In London, lower by about 0.5%. In Germany, higher by 0.25%. And in France, down by just a fraction. The trading day ending in Asia with the Nikkei up nearly 70 points for a third. In Hong Kong, up nearly 223 points, up nearly three-quarters. In China, up nearly three-quarters as well. Oil is trading at, 56.37 a barrel here in the United States. A couple of stories as we begin, just a couple of headlines. The United Auto Workers strike against General Motors is over. The union and GM reached a four-year labor contract after a 40-day strike, which cost the company more than $2 billion. In exchange for bonuses and raises for the auto workers, the union agreed not to block GM's plans to shut down four facilities across the United States. Chicago Public Schools will be on strike again today. We'll keep you posted on that during the news segments as we move forward this hour. And the U.S. federal deficit for this fiscal year will just miss the $1 trillion mark. U.S. Treasury reported the federal deficit for 2019 is $984 billion. The nation's debt approaching nearly $23 trillion. Let's begin this morning as giving season is about to get underway. Lots of scams out there, lots of places where you could give your money and never see it again and never see it do what you want it to do. Doug White is with us this morning, philanthropy advisor, author of Wounded Charity, Lessons Learned from the Wounded Warrior Project Crisis. Doug, good morning. Welcome to WGN.
Well, thank you for that, Steve, and good morning to you and to all of your listeners in the Chicago area.
I think most of us remember the Wounded Warrior situation, that scam, the how that all unfolded, but remind us again what that was about.
In late January of 2016, both the New York Times and CBS News ran stories that alleged that the Wounded Warrior Project staff had been misusing money and had been spending it on conferences that were too lavish and were not reporting their numbers correctly to the IRS. As it turns out, essentially none of that was true. So what we know about that scandal, we pretty much don't know. And I talk about this with a lot of people, and they say, oh, yes, that's that charity that did X, Y, or Z. And the real truth of the matter is, Steve, that after examining this in some detail, I found that all of the allegations were just either misleading or completely false.
It brings up, though, the idea that we see things, we hear things, maybe we don't even know things about the places where we're giving. How does that need to change? And what do we need to know, and where do we find it about these organizations?
The IRS and attorneys general in each state are tasked with oversight of charities, but they don't really do a very good job of oversight. Much of that is not their fault. They're understaffed. And so the most important resource for people is, I think, the media. And the media has done, I think, a fairly good job, despite what I just said about the issue at Warden Courier Project. Overall, I think the media has done a good job of keeping these issues in the forefront for the public. But lacking that, people need to do their own research. It's a buyer's beware, in this case, donations beware situation where individuals need to do their own homework. And the process there is not so much looking at just the numbers, that is to say how much is going to program or how much is going to fundraising costs, but to try to evaluate impact. And when I say that without any prejudice toward any one particular organization or even sector, because everyone has his or her own beliefs or own loves, and that should be promoted. But by the same token, the organization that is talking about doing work in that sector needs to be doing a good job. And the donor or the listener here or the public in general needs to take a look at the impact of the organization and find out what it is doing for its community.
Yeah, and this may all just begin with a Google search, but even then it's kind of difficult. I know that these charities are evaluated in a lot of different ways. Does that process need to change so that perhaps there's one overriding way this is done for every charity so they're all on not only a level playing field, but we all get the same information about the charity?
I would like to have a situation where we do get the right information, the same information, and the right information. Right now, you're right, the system has to change. We rely on organizations that use only the information that is sent to the IRS, which is not a lot. It's all financial, and a lot of what is calculated within that financial process is not really relevant. For example, you might find that a charity is spending 50% instead of 90% on a program. That doesn't make it a bad charity. It may have a bad year, or it may be doing something very good with the other 50%. We really don't know, and we shouldn't make a judgment based solely on those numbers. So an organization has to do more than just provide numbers. It needs to actually provide narratives about its impact, about, as I said before, how it really affects the community it's in. So the charity evaluation situation does need to change dramatically. I've offered an idea, but it's fairly comprehensive in the book. It's fairly comprehensive, and it's not going to be easy to do, but I do believe we need to be thinking more about why a charity exists rather than just its numbers.
Yeah, and it's very difficult, I think, because you mentioned a couple of things that I do when I find a charity, and that is if there's too much of the money being used for the operational part of it, I generally shy away from that. But it's interesting to hear you say that that may not be the case. So what do you do? Pick up the phone and call the charity, reach out to somebody at the charity and ask questions firsthand?
I would suggest that as number one. Now, I know a lot of people think that's a lot of work, and it is. But by the same token, this is money that you have earned, that you are giving away. And you're doing it with a lot of love in your heart. You're doing it because you love the veterans, or you love the animals, or you love the environment, or you love the perspective of the charity. And so we don't ever take that away. But in support of that, I think the donor really needs to take that donation seriously enough to actually touch base with the charity, ask some really tough questions like, what are you doing with my money? How do I know you're going to do that with my money? And go from there. Even the conversation on the telephone would be, I think, revealing for a donor to get a sense of whether that charity is really legitimate.
Doug, do you have a sense of how much money goes bad here, I guess, for a lack of a better way to describe it? When we give to a charity, we all think it's doing good. But do you have any numbers in terms of how much of the money might be going back to bad sources?
I would estimate that over $1 billion a year goes to bad sources. Keep in mind that about $400 billion or more really goes to charity in general from all sources, and about 75% of that comes from individuals. So let's say $300 billion or so comes from individuals to charities. At least $1 billion or $2 billion goes is spent badly by the charities. Whether it's fraud or not is another question. But I believe that regardless of whether it's fraud, the donor really wants to make sure that the money is being used in the way he or she wants it and that it is being spent well.
Doug, I want to get to that foolproof foundation in a minute, but I want to ask you specifically about whether there are charities right now that you know of that you would tell people absolutely do not donate to.
Right now, I can't give you any specific charities, but I will tell you this in terms of characteristics. Avoid two things. One is, if someone calls you on the telephone and says, give to this charity, do not give as a result of that telephone call. If you feel close to the organization the person is talking about, look that charity up on the web. Find out if there is any information about it publicly. But do not use that phone call as your sole reason for making a gift to a charity. It's very possible the charity is a good one, but it's also very possible it's either a bad charity or it's not a charity, or that it's not using its money well. And the second issue is I would avoid charities that are brand new, especially when it comes to the giving season. As you said earlier, we're coming up toward the end of the year. It is the giving season. Lots and lots of charity scams are born during this period of time. And you want to be absolutely sure this charity is at least legitimate. It may not be enough to just go ahead and find out how they're spending their money, but you want to make sure the organization is an organization. And you can do that by going to their website or by going to a place called GuideStar.org, which has the list of all charities in the United States, and it's fairly easy to navigate. So that's the suggestion right now. In terms of actual specific organizations, in the past there have been, but luckily a lot of them have been put out of business. So, but those are the characteristics I would look for.
Giving Tuesday is December 3rd, so we're getting close to that date, and we might see some of those fake charities or those bad charities pop up now as we approach that day. I mentioned earlier a couple of times you're the co-chair of the Foolproof Foundation's Walter Cronkite Project Committee. This is a wonderful idea because it sort of goes to the heart of what we're talking about here today, to give people the education, to help them understand this process and how all of this works to make better decisions.
I don't spend a lot of time personally giving my time to charities other than those that I have absolutely kicked the tires with. Foolproof is not only a good organization, it's a small organization and it's growing. And its impact is far beyond its fundraising, and they need to do more of that. They need to have better support. But by the same token, they also emphasize ethical activity, and this is a big part of my teaching over the last 20 years. In addition to teaching about how charities should be run, part of that is about ethical decision-making, and the people of Foolproof are about as ethical as I've ever seen an organization be. And you're right, they talk about critical thinking and financial literacy. Started by a friend of Walter Cronkite's, they got together a young man by the name of Will DeHoo, and Walter Cronkite talked about the need for this because in news, you really need to be talking about the truth and be critical when you're thinking. And so that's a great organization. It's in many, many schools throughout the United States, and I hope it grows.
Yeah, and back to the Wounded Charity, the Wounded Warrior Project. Here's back to how that all was covered. That organization doing well today, does it continue on, or was that the end of it?
Wounded Warrior Project is still healthy, and I would suggest anyone who likes what they do, and they do a lot, to continue to support the organization. So let me get that straight. I also want to be clear that I don't have any real broad criticism of news organizations. The New York Times and CBS are very fine organizations, but they did blow it in this situation. The impact, however, was fairly strong. They lost over $650 million over the following 3 years after this crisis and the two people were fired. And so they have had to really retool. I don't believe they have the same big vision they had, because their vision was to take care of many of the veterans who come home, and they're going to need care for the next 50 or 60 years. And so the people who were running it before, the staff people who were running it before, really were looking at it in that long-term way. I know that one program has been stopped, but by the same token, it's still a very good organization, And there's no hint of scandal at it at all.
Well, Doug, we appreciate you being on with us this morning and sharing some of your expertise. Thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure, Steve, to be with you.
Doug White, a philanthropy advisor, author of Wounded Charity, Lessons Learned from the Wounded Warrior Project Crisis, also co-chair of Foolproof Foundation's Walter Cronkite Project Committee. By the way, you can find them online at foolprooffoundation.org, and we'll link out to some more of Doug White's contact information as well.
Now, WGN Radio's Daily Conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Monday edition of The Opening Bell. A couple of developing business stories this morning. One involves Tiffany, the jewelry company. A share is up nearly 20% after the French luxury group LVMH makes a $14.5 billion takeover bid. Also this morning, Facebook says it has removed an ad that falsely claimed Republican Senator Lindsey Graham supported the Green New Deal, demonstrating that it will, in fact, fact-check ads from political groups, but apparently not politicians. The ad was ran on Friday, put up as a stunt by a left-leaning political action committee. Let's switch to Wisconsin and Foxconn. As the company develops a massive industrial complex in the southeast portion of the state, there is some question about whether or not those technology centers, those innovation centers, will ever come to fruition. Joining us this morning is Dale Buss, a contributor at Chief Executive Magazine, The New York Times, Wall Street Journal, to talk a little bit about this. Dale, good morning. Welcome back to WGN.
Thank you, Steve.
Remind us again what these innovation centers are.
The innovation centers, there are supposed to be four or five of them around the state, and it was partly a way to spread the impact of Foxconn and its technology and its investment beyond what former Governor Scott Walker called Wisconn Valley, meaning the portion of the state, southeastern portion of the state, where the big Foxconn plant is going up. And the idea was to kind of sprinkle technology investment, the expertise in engineering and what Foxconn does around the state to build political support for the it was about $4 billion in state and local tax incentives that Walker decided that to give to Foxconn to build this big plant to manufacture glass screens for computers and other applications. And it's just kind of the latest wrinkle in a bumpy story for Foxconn and Wisconsin, which has involved delays in building the main plant, delays in hiring, lots of questions over how the U.S.-China trade war would affect Foxconn's business. Again, it's just the latest wrinkle in a relationship that has been way more rocky than certainly Walker counted on, because he didn't get re-election in part because of the problems in this relationship. And really, it's not what the people of Wisconsin have looked for necessarily.
Yeah, Foxconn says it's focusing on developing that big campus in the southeast part of the state in Racine County. Do you get a sense that it feels like it's going to renege on some of those promises to do some of those other economic development projects?
What Foxconn said when Wisconsin Public Radio reported on this was that it's prioritizing that campus, and it has every intention to end up building these innovation centers. It's just they're less of a priority. And probably in the big picture, if those things don't go as smoothly as Foxconn initially indicated, and yet the main plant that's taking shape near Racine, you know, is initially planned or close to it, I think Wisconsin officials probably would be understanding, let's say, about delays in Foxconn putting together these other innovation centers. Again, the big picture is this was one of the biggest wins for a state, wins in quotes, when Wisconsin got the Foxconn project, and a few, you know, and President Trump came, helped break ground, that it was going to revitalize and diversify the economy of Wisconsin, and it was going to be a big deal for the country. And of course, it's just, it may end up being that, but so far it's been a story of disappointment.
Yeah, so far it feels like it's been a dud. And there are folks in some of these communities, Milwaukee, Green Bay, Eau Claire, Racine, and Madison, they're hoping for some of these jobs. I think there were several hundred high-skilled jobs that were supposed to be connected to these innovation centers.
Right. Foxconn said it'd be hiring between 100 to 200 people to work in such jobs in each center. And in Milwaukee, it was going to create more than 500 jobs. Hasn't happened yet. But interestingly, you know, what has happened in the meantime is that people in Milwaukee, for example, have kind of taken upon their own shoulders the idea of overhauling their economy. And a bunch of CEOs in Milwaukee last week announced the creation of what they're calling the MKE Tech Hub, which is oriented toward developing the kind of digital tech jobs in the Milwaukee area that will attract and keep millennials and give them the opportunity to work on problems and challenges in legacy companies. You know, rather than just creating another app for teenagers, there are companies like Northwestern Mutual and Kohl's that are saying, you know, we need digital tech workers to truly transform the economy in Milwaukee, and you know, we're going to invest some money in trying to make this a more attractive environment for these people.
Yeah, that's a kind of a cool thing, too, that you're talking about the MKE Tech Hub. This coalition of business leaders that are getting together on this, they have a really good idea. I wouldn't be surprised if other cities, other states steal this idea.
Yeah, it's, in a sense, Milwaukee is copying some groundbreaking work that's going on in other places, notably Indianapolis, for example, which, you know, you're facing a dilemma in flyover country about how to develop your economy in a digital era when Silicon Valley and the East Coast are the natural places to go for people who've got this kind of expertise. Fortunately, though, places like Milwaukee and Indianapolis, smaller cities across the heartland, have been able to begin pitching themselves in a couple of different ways. One is a much lower cost of living, less frustration, you know, personally and individually for people to get to work and to afford to live in places. But interestingly, they're also pitching the fact that places like Milwaukee and obviously Chicago have legacy industries that have interesting kinds of problems for engineers and people who work on technical problems. They're in all these businesses that are themselves being transformed digitally. And so they're able to say, hey, we're at Northwestern Mutual. You know, we need somebody to help project future trends in finance. We're at Kohl's, so obviously undergoing this huge battle with e-commerce. We need people to help us do that with our own digital expertise. And so, you know, these are the kinds of things that can attract people, as well as I said, the ability to maybe develop the next Snapchat or whatever it is.
Yeah, in your story, the latest chiefexecutive.net, you talk write more about this, some of the companies involved. Johnson Controls, Kohl's, Advocate, Aurora Health, Accenture, they have some lofty goals here. They want to nearly double the tech worker count by 2025.
Right. I guess it's easy to throw numbers out. I mean, who knows if that actually would happen. But if it doesn't happen, or if this coalition and other Milwaukee companies are not able to make the city attractive for keeping, you know, Wisconsin-bred tech workers, and even to attract others, then the future of the local economy is certainly going to be in question. Because across the country, every single legacy company, and not every single, but most of them obviously are dealing with the necessity to overhaul what they do and how they work, and, you know, the very nature of their business to compete in the digital era. I mean, Kohl's is a great example. For example, several months ago, Michelle Gass, the new CEO, said, you know, we need to shake things up here, so we're going to start taking Amazon returns, and we're going to generate floor traffic in our physical stores by just becoming a huge depot for accepting Amazon returns and making it easy for people to send things back to Amazon that they don't want, returning purchases. And so far, that's kind of worked out well for Kohl's, has helped build traffic. They're still trying to get a handle on what kind of expenses that it's going to involve over the long term. And I think a big test will be after the Christmas holiday, when you'll probably find lines at your Kohl's store for people sending things back to Amazon.
Yeah, and perhaps even shopping for a winter coat if they put those close to the Amazon line. Dale, I have to ask you
this. That's the idea.
Yeah, that's the idea, right? The Democratic convention in Milwaukee next year, how will that play into some of these ideas and plans? I'm sure this would be a nice little way to promote this tech venture in Milwaukee.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, certainly since Milwaukee got the nod for the convention, the city has been trying to figure out all sorts of ways to make sure that it's day in the sun, its star turn on the international stage goes well in terms of accommodations, in terms of transportation, all that kind of thing. But the leaders of this MKE Tech Hub certainly are hoping that in the next, you know, several months, they're able to get things off the ground enough that they can maybe demonstrate to the delegates coming to the convention, look, Milwaukee is a, not only a progressive place and a fun place to be for conventioneers, but when it comes to the economy, we're diversifying. We're exemplary of what can happen in a heartland state, you know, where the business leaders are determined to help transform the economy. And yeah, there's a big circle on the calendars of people like John Schlifske, the CEO of Northwestern Mutual, for that Democratic convention next year.
All right, Dale, good stuff. We appreciate you being on with us this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dale Buss, and you can read his latest at chiefexecutive.net.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market, desk futures are pointing toward a positive open on Wall Street this morning. Dow futures are up 78 points. NASDAQ and S&P futures are higher as well. Mixed day in Europe so far. London, the only of the markets that are lower there today. And a positive day in Asia. The Nikkei in Tokyo up nearly a third. Stocks in China and Hong Kong up by nearly 0.75%. Let's get an update on agriculture and commodities now. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. Looking back to last Friday and closing prices in grains and livestock, it was a mixed ending to the week. December corn managed a gain of a penny a bushel, but November soybeans dropped 10.5 cents. Again, China, the disappointment because traders thought they'd be buying more soybeans than they actually are. And then add to that, of course, the delays in harvest in some parts of the country, speed up of harvest in other parts of the country, all having an impact on the market. Again, China with no more pork imports from the United States, an effect in the livestock trade. February hog contract ended the day up 25 cents a hundredweight, and that was it. Cattle futures, however, live cattle and feeder cattle did end the week higher. Our neighbors to the north in Wisconsin, members of the state legislature in Wisconsin, did pursue changes in state law to ban labeling food as meat, milk, or dairy if they don't contain those products. A state Senate committee held last week on the proposals that bill sponsors argue is needed to protect Wisconsin's agriculture and dairy industries from what they argue is misleading food labeling. And Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin has also pursued similar legislation at the federal level. It still has to make its way through the state legislature in Wisconsin and, of course, through Congress. So we'll be hoping for good harvesting weather for all of you this week. That's agribusiness. Have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You as well. From the earnings reports this morning, CNA Financial from Chicago reporting third quarter income of $107 million. The Chicago-based company said it had net income of 39 cents per share. Earnings adjusted for one-time gains and costs were $1.16 per share. The results topping Wall Street expectations. JetBlue is charging a $5 fee to check a carry-on bag. The airline is testing out at Orlando's airport to see if customers like it. The idea is to make the boarding process go faster if fewer people need to use the overhead bins. It also means not having to carry bags through security. JetBlue will gather feedback from customers and crews before deciding whether or not to make this permanent or not. A survey has found that a measure of hiring by U.S. companies has fallen to a 7-year low, and fewer employers are raising pay. 1/5 of the economists surveyed by the National Association for Business Economics say their companies have hired workers in the past 3 months. That's down from 1/3 in July. Job totals were unchanged at 69% of companies, up from 57% in July. Broad measure of job gains in the survey fell to its lowest level since October 2012. The International Monetary Fund says political uncertainty and volatile oil prices are hindering economic growth in the Middle East this year. The oil part of that could impact global markets as well. The IMF's Regional Outlook report projects growth to rise just 0.5% in 2019 compared to 1.6% in 2018. Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for this Monday, October the 28th. Wholesale inventories for September come out this morning. Analysts are forecasting a 0.2% increase, matching the 0.2% gain in August. We'll see those numbers come out mid-morning. Also today, the Chicago Fed National Activity Index is due. The Dallas Manufacturing Survey is out as well. On the earnings calendar today, AT&T, Spotify, Walgreens, Alphabet, CNA Financial, and Beyond Meat earnings, just some of the things that could move the markets on this Monday, October 28th.